in a complex space of parameters. So only very recently, in fact, I've been working on this for many, many years, and I've been rather frustrated. I've been making the same stupid mistake for 14 years, something like that. And only in the past 3 weeks have I understood exactly what happens. And here's the joke, though. I'm not going to explain it to you because it's too complicated. And so what I'm going to explain to you is something just for SL2, and I'll give you a hint of what happens for that. So the higher rank groups are really quite complicated still, but much easier than I used to think. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to explain pretty much what happens for SL2, and then this already is a little bit complicated, but kind of fun, actually. I enjoyed making that calculation. And then I'll give you a hint of what happens for the higher rank groups. And the interesting part is, and I think the reason that this particular topic is even of some interest, is because it sheds some new light on Arthur's truncation theory. And I wouldn't call Arthur's truncation theory a backwater, but the chances are there's nobody in this room who actually understands completely the full theory. Because I certainly have it on the testimony of one well-known witness that he does not understand all of it himself and could not reproduce his own proofs. But I think there's a great deal to be said. So for those of you who haven't looked at Arthur's truncation theory, and that includes most of us, I should say that it's really the obstacle to understanding automorphic forms in higher dimensions is to understand the truncation theory well. It really, and there's something very subtle about it, which I won't have time to talk about, but I'll just make a few buzzwords, is that the truncation theory is somehow connected with compactifications of arithmetic quotients. But the kind of topology you get on these compactifications is rather odd. There's some kind of, I don't know what today, some sophisticated theory which the truncation theory relies on and has not been explored at all. And the ultimate hope would be that you could, in some sense, in the long run, perhaps make the theory of the Selberg trace formula even a little more understandable by using this topology. But in order to do that, you have to understand the truncation theory better. Anyway, I'll explain what happens for SL2. So let me start by just writing down the usual Eisenstein series. So we take gamma. So all the usual things. So gamma, for quite a while, will just be SL2Z. And H is the upper half plane. K is that. G is SL2R. P is this. And A and N and so on. They're all the usual things. And so I take the usual Eisenstein series, which is y of gamma z to the s plus 1/2. So this is the Mach-Eisenstein series. And now, of course, we know that this does not converge in the interesting part. So the continuous spectrum is the unitary spectrum. Is where the real part of S is equal to zero in this normalization, and the Eisenstein series do not converge there. So this will play a role later on when I remind you of this fact. If it did somehow, then the whole talk that everything I'm going to say, if for some magical reason these things did converge, then everything I have to say is completely trivial. So somehow what I'm saying, as far as I can see, is not trivial. I'm still not convinced there's not some really trivial way of approaching the Poincaré measure. But as far as I can see, it doesn't, in fact, there is no triviality. Okay. So now, but I'm interested in this talk, I'll be interested only in the case. Absolutely no other points. Okay, so we're looking at the unitary axis. I'll remind you that E of S is equal to E of, well, that the constant term of E of S looks like this, and it has asymptotic behavior determined by that constant term. And that E of S, this is unique in some sense with this asymptotic behavior, and E of S satisfies the functional equation that looks like this. And therefore, you can deduce that C of S and C of minus S is equal to 1. And now, what's the Poincaré measure concerned with? Well, I take a function phi a member of C of 0 infinity, a function y, excuse me, a function of s, excuse me, yeah, no, let me. So it's a function of s, and it's CC infinity. Infinity doesn't actually play a role. And I define what's, I don't know what the name for such a thing is. It's still an Eisenstein series of sorts. It's an integral of phi of s times e of s ds. What's the name for these things, Jim? Hirschhorn calls them wave packets, but it's a terrible, I don't know, whatever. Anyway, it is what it is. Terrible notation. Anyway, whatever they are, that's I'll call it an Eisenstein series determined by phi. And so this is by, we know what the asymptotic behavior of the Eisenstein series is. It's given by this. And so this is equal to O. Just classical Fourier analysis tells you that this is equal to O of log y minus n for all n. And there's no trouble with convergence because phi has compact support. Let me erase this. And so I can integrate this. Because of this logarithmic rapid decrease, E of phi, E of t makes sense. There's no problems with convergence in this case. And the question is, so the Poincaré question, so to speak. And the answer is quite simple. So let's see. Let's define phi star of s. This is E of phi. It's on the left. And on the right, yes. Well, it's E of minus t. Yes, exactly. T is just some arbitrary.
E is equal to s.
Sure, if you want. Or minus s, if you want. Or something. Yeah, T is also a member of the real part. Equals 0. Well, it's the logarithmic decrease. So we know that the Eisenstein series, so E of t is asymptotic in this case to y of t and y of, 1/2. Y of 1/2 plus t, and then some other term is 1/2 minus t. And then E of phi is logarithmic decrease, and the integral is against dx dy, y squared, not dy, and so the halves cancel out, so this becomes this, and so it just becomes a classical computation. The question of convergence. The fact is that these, that log y minus n is integrable against dy over y. Okay. And what is this? And, well, let me explain that. So I define a new function of s, which is phi of s plus c of minus s, phi of minus s. And this is basically a projection of phi onto a set of functions satisfying a functional equation. Phi of minus s is equal to, phi of s satisfies a functional equation. Phi of s equals c of minus s, phi of minus s. So this is basically plus or minus, except for a factor of 2, it's a projection of phi onto functions satisfying a functional equation. And now, the Poincaré theorem says that this is equal to phi star of minus t. So that is the theorem. Phi star of minus t. Yep. Okay. And you can see that, so the usual way of stating the Poincaré theorem is in terms of something else, that would say that e phi paired with e some other function psi is equal to 1/2 times an inner product determined by the two things here. But this is actually an easy consequence. Okay. This is just an immediate consequence by ordinary Fourier analysis of the consequence of this. But this is the slightly more fundamental theorem. Okay, now, it's exactly this theorem, which is rather elementary in a sense, if the Eisenstein series converge there. So let me state the following fact. Suppose that f is a rapidly decreasing function of y. I won't be precise about that. Then I define a function EF. It's a little confusing, my notation. I don't know any really good way of doing it. So here phi is a function of S, but here F is a function of Y. And then I define this to be this F of Y. Yeah, let's see. F of Y of gamma Z. Okay, so this is an Eisenstein series associated to F. And because this is rapidly decreasing in Y, there's no convergence troubles there. And now there's what I call the adjoint property, which is very elementary under these conditions of convergence. If I take EF and I pair it with any function, phi, on the arithmetic quotient, then this is equal to F paired with the constant term of phi. I'll call this phi zero. On 0 infinity with respect to the measure dy over y squared, where phi 0 is a constant term of phi. And so I can, and if I take this equation, and if this worked, if I could set f equal to the inverse Fourier transform of phi, and I take phi to be equal to e to the minus t, then, well, over here I have the, basically it's not quite clear, but what this really is this is the constant term, so then what I get is the following. I get f paired with, and now in this case the constant term is y to the minus t plus c minus t y to the t, and this is on 0 infinity with respect to dy y squared. But this is just the Fourier transform of f, and this is ct, the Fourier transform of minus t. And if this works, if the Eisenstein series for f actually converges, then I can apply this to this. There's no restriction on the phi whatsoever, and then I get this. And now, under these circumstances, if I take my f to be the inverse Fourier transform of phi, then I wind up exactly with this. So, and this is actually the starting point. This equation right here is in some sense, not quite obviously, not literally, but in some sense the starting point of Langlands and Selberg's derivation of the Poincaré measure. So they start with this, they start with a function exactly of this kind, a function of compact, both of them start with a function of compact support as a function of y. They make an Eisenstein series out of that. They take the pairing of two of these things, and they apply what I call the adjoint property to that, and then they have to move contours around to make things work. And so, as I say, if this Eisenstein series converged, then this would be a trivial consequence of the whole business. You don't look like you're understanding it all. I've left you behind. Somebody right there. No.
I don't quite understand. I mean, when you say F is the inverse Fourier transform.
Yeah, in other words, I can define right, I can just define the inverse I have to take care of all these normalizations and so on. I have to be a little careful. But if I just define f of y to be this, then that becomes the inverse. This is the formula for the inverse Fourier transform. And so Leibniz goes the other way. Basically Leibniz does exactly this. So, this is, f of y is the inverse Fourier. In other words, the relation between phi and f is given by either f is the inverse Fourier transform of phi or phi is the inverse.
I'm sorry, you're iterating over y, so you can't have f of y.
There's a hat. Yeah, I'm integrating over s. I'm integrating over. Ds. Yeah, that's a good. Sorry. Right. That's the formula for inverse Fourier transform. And so formally, as I say, this theorem is a triviality. That's where everybody begins at exactly the same point. You start with a formal triviality, and somehow you have to make some sense out of it. In Langland's case, as I say, he does this because in Langland's case, I have if I take my phi to be of compact support, then its Fourier transform is analytic and has very nice properties everywhere in the complex plane. And so I can choose my contour to be someplace where this is like zero. And then under these circumstances, I can integrate over the Eisenstein series as well. I can make sense out of this thing, not just over zero, but I can actually choose sigma. And that's the starting point of Langland's proof. But then, as I say, the consequence is that you're forced to move. You start with your contour over sigma, but you really want a contour over zero. And so you're forced to move in and see what residues and so on you pick up. And as you know, it's a very messy argument. And so there's reasons to wonder if you can get by with that without doing that. And that's exactly what I want to do. Okay. I'll have one more blackboard. Okay, so let me write down some things. So now let's go back to phi. So I take phi, remember, of CC infinity of real part of S equals 0. And I define capital phi equal the inverse Fourier transform of this. So it's but I'm going to normalize things so that I forget the S factor here. It's just this. So this is a function on of y. So this is the inverse Fourier transform of phi. And I define another function, and this will be an L2 by the usual Fourier theory. I define this to be the same thing, but for phi star. Okay, so now I have two functions. So both phi and phi star, phi hash rather, are at L2 of 0 infinity in the usual sense with respect to dy. So that just gives me a little notation. And now, yes. Okay. Okay, so let me write that again. So we have E phi is equal to 1 over 2 pi I, the integral real part of S equals 0, phi of S, E of S, ds. And the E of minus T is minus T. So what you want to do is write down the following. Formally, this is what I get. If I just pair this with this, then, of course, I'm taking the inner product of these two things. But, of course, I can't do that because this makes no sense. Right? I'm pretty good at making sense out of stupid things like this, but in this case, I don't see any way to do it. So the idea is that I have to rewrite this expression somehow. And so this makes no sense, but we can make it make sense by applying the truncation theory. Okay, so I choose t, a real number greater than 1, and I define an operator ct, so if phi is any function on gamma h, basically, then I apply a kind of truncation operator ct, and that's just equal to the constant term of phi truncated to the region y greater than t, or greater than or equal to t. And as you know, so that's this, and so I define the other truncation, the real truncation is the phi minus this truncated constant term. And then we have an orthogonal decomposition. Phi is equal to the truncation plus this constant term, and this is an orthogonal decomposition. And so now I write my E phi, well, this is equal to 1 over 2 pi I integral real part of S equals 0, but it's equal to the truncated part, phi of S. Phi of S ds, and plus 1 over 2 pi I real part of S equals 0, phi of S times the constant term part. Okay. And now, when I pair this, I can pair these separately with e of minus t. And this is equal to, and this is the truncated part. This is e of phi, and this is what I'll call c of t, phi of t. And so I write my thing like this, plus 1. Okay. Now, the second part is basically something that's taking place just in the function of y alone. This ct, this is basically a function of y alone, and when I truncate sort of off by the constant term, then of course this is still an orthogonal operator. So everything, so the calculation of this just depends on Fourier analysis on that. I'll explain in a moment. So I can write this down as something which makes sense classically in abelian Fourier analysis. So the second term equals the integral, it's equal to the integral from t to infinity of the constant term of e phi times the constant term of e to the minus t. And this is with respect to dy squared, excuse me. And now I can rewrite this again. I have my functions over here. So this is just phi star, integral from 0 to infinity of phi star times y of minus t plus c of t, c of minus t, y to the t. And this is exactly right, like that. Okay. Because this is that's all this is. So this is just an integral from t to infinity of a function of y alone. But for the second part, it now makes sense to put the thing inside the integral. So this part is equal to this. Everything's fine. So now, since I have the truncated thing, and since the truncated thing is... I haven't said that, but I'll say it in just a moment. Okay. When I truncate, when I chop off the constant term of a function, the constant term is the asymptotic behavior of the function, basically. And when I subtract off the constant term, I get something rapidly decreasing. So now I can integrate the truncated Eisenstein series against an ordinary Eisenstein series. And so that makes perfectly good sense, and so the integral makes perfectly good sense. And now I have an expression for this. And there's a rather messy expression for this, which is due to Maas and Selberg in this case, and to Arthur and Langlands in general. Okay, let me write down what that expression is. And what's the next step? That's what I don't see. So you're saying I should... Well, maybe. Well. What's the inverse step? Oh, okay. I think it's this broke. Yeah, that would be... I mean, I'm inclined to try anything, but I think it's this broke here. I did it. You saw, but the funny thing is, you saw me do it. That's right. It's a Hitchcock movie, right? It's the crime was committed while everybody was watching, but nobody knows. Agatha Christie, not Hitchcock. It's sort of. So I don't know. Let's see. How am I gonna? I'll just move over to it. Yeah, okay. I'll just move over to another board for a while. So we have this. So the basic formula here is a formula for exactly this thing. This is the key result. And as I say, this is equal to and now by Maas Selberg. What does Maas Selberg say? Well, let me write it down in the way to remember. So first of all, yeah, okay. Maas Selberg formula gives you, to tell you the truth, I've never seen it. So have you read it in Selberg's paper? It must be in there somewhere, but I have no idea how he proves it. The first proof I was made aware of was by Kubota in his book on Eisenstein's series, where he claims to be just reproducing what Selberg says. And what he does, he applies one of the standard differential geometric theorems, the boundary values, some sort of form of Green's theorem to this. I haven't. I will in a moment. Have patience. I thought this was your formula. Is this not your formula? Not the way I've written it, no. There will be in just a second. In just 1 second, or 2 seconds, or 10 seconds, something very short. This is the way I write, because this is the way to remember it. So it's true that there is a form in the denominator, but the way to remember the formula is to remember it. Maybe this is my formula. So the way to remember it is to remember it like this, because... First of all, there's a way to derive it where you actually derive it in these terms. And second of all, this makes no sense whatsoever, but it makes good formal sense, as I'll say in just a moment. This actually never converges, this integral. But it can be defined by analytic continuation in S and T. And then you get the denominator form, which I'll say in a moment. But the way to remember it is, if I take the product of two truncated Eisenstein series, I take the product of their constant terms and integrate from 0 to T against dy dy. Actually, there's a half missing here, but that's taken care of by that. This is the way to remember the formula. And it turns out there's actually a derivation of this, which is more or less along these same lines, which I have somewhere. But the point is, now I can write this out. And so basically, this formula is defined by analytic continuation in S and T. And the reason this works, so let's see. Let's actually see what we've got when we do this. Let's just look at one of the terms. So when I multiply this out, I get four terms. If I have an arbitrary group, there'll be the number of vial elements here and a number of terms equal to the cardinality of the vial group here and the same here. So there will be W squared terms. Let's just look at one of these terms. 0 to t y to the s minus t dy dy. And it's just a calculus exercise. This is equal to y to the s minus t over s minus t evaluated at t and, 0 and t. And so this is equal t to the s minus t over s minus t. So it's only after integration that I get the denominators. Now, the crucial thing is that these functions are now L2, so this always exists. It doesn't matter whether S is equal to T and so on, but the individual terms here have denominators and are quite messy, but somehow the sum works out not to have any poles at all. So the total expression, so I'll write out in just a moment what the final expression is, but the total expression has no poles in S and T. That's actually the crucial fact that makes the rest of the calculation work, in spite of the denominators here. And so I'll now write out what that expression is. Oh, and this is times phi of s. Oh, no, this is not times phi of s. Excuse me. This is times phi of s. So that's what goes in there. So now when I write out the whole thing, I get something rather messy. In higher rank, of course, you have to do more work to make this make sense. And then times, let's see, it's the integral phi of s t to the s minus t over s minus t ds times plus integral phi of s c of s t minus s minus t over minus s t ds plus c of minus t phi of s t to the s plus t over s plus t ds plus c of minus t integral phi of s c of s minus s, excuse me. No, phi of s c of s t to the minus s plus t all ds. And then times that. Okay. Now, as I say, this total expression is holomorphic in S and T. The individual terms are not. Now, the question is, what are we looking at exactly? Well, the total expression... Yeah. No. They both have real value of S equal to zero. That's all. As I say, throughout the whole talk, everything is on the unitary axis.
Don't you have a problem when you go to zero, when you integrate dy over y, when you integrate that?
These things are defined by analytic continuation. Uh-huh. I've said that. This expression, the integral, makes sense only by analytic continuation. I mean, that's how they have to interpret the whole thing. You fool around, and then the whole integral is defined by analytic continuation. There's certainly no question that it never converges for all of these all at once. But that's all right. You don't care. No, there's no. Oh yeah, the same thing. Yeah, it's defined. And then you add, but it analytically continues. So this expression is to be interpreted in terms of analytic continuation anyway. So I mean the proof that I say. So there's some formal business going on here that I'm not explaining, but it's formal. The point is you don't have to know. You can use the black box. Now, this expression, the total sum of things, is good for all values of S and T. There's no meromorphicity whatsoever. And so I can restrict myself. For example, this integral clearly makes sense if I bound this away from this, for example. So I'm going to add another later to this, I'm going to have a parameter called epsilon. And each one of these integrals makes sense. So for this one, I take the limit epsilon goes to 0. In this case, it's s plus t bounded away from epsilon. In this case, s plus t. In this case, s minus t, and so on. So each one of these, I can do this because I can take this on the outside, and as I say, this whole expression is holomorphic, so there's no restriction when I do this. So each one of these, so this expression is a component. And now this expression makes sense on its own. Why is that, Mr. Arthur? What are the magic two words? This is a test in your classical Fourier analysis. Exactly right. I see you're cheating. Jesus, what did you do? Bribe the instructor to this. I don't remember that. But you're right. I mean, the point is that it's a principal value. So this is the evaluation of some, this has something to do with the evaluation of a principal value distribution. And so you use the whole, so in fact, for all groups whatsoever, you always go through exactly the same thing. You get a formula for the truncation of Eisenstein series, which is itself holomorphic and has no poles whatsoever. You break that up into a sum of a finite number of terms, W times W of them, and each one of the terms can be interpreted in terms of a principal value. And so what you get when you're through is that this, evaluated at this, is the sum of a bunch of something to do, I'll explain in a moment exactly what, something to do with principal value distributions on things connected with phi. So, but the point is that it reduces to a calculation purely in terms of abelian classical Fourier analysis. So at this point, we are reduced completely to classical Fourier analysis. So, and this is exactly what you want, really. I mean, the whole theory of Eisenstein series, in some sense, the whole point of the manipulations is to reduce yourself from the Eisenstein series. So when we start off, we have this rather nasty expression. We're dealing with an inner product of something rather messy on an arithmetic quotient. But because of the Mass-Selberg relation, we can immediately reduce this computation to something that takes place only in one dimension in a classical group. And the same thing happens every time for every conceivable type of unitary Eisenstein series, actually. You always get the Mass-Selberg equation becomes a little messier. When you induce, for example, a residual discrete Eisenstein series, you have to be very careful, but still something happens that enables you to reduce the calculation to a calculation on, in general, an abelian group of dimension equal to the rank. Okay, so we have this expression. And the question is, what does it mean? What are we exactly are we looking at? And so that's the last part of the talk, is to tell you what exactly we are looking at. First of all, let's look at the following function. So it's 1 here, it's 0 here, and this is 1 on the multiplicative group. So this is the multiplicative group, and I call this function sine, and it's equal either to, no, excuse me, I call this, this is the characteristic function, excuse me. This is the characteristic function of 0 and 1 infinity on the multiplicative group. Now, I take its multiplicative Fourier transform, and, well, if you think additively, then you know what you get. It's a classical computation. Its Fourier transform is 1/2 times the delta function in S plus the principal value of 1 over S. This is a classical computation in your basic thing. And now, so this we don't really want. What we want to do is this, so that's fine. We subtract off something which has this, so if we take my function chi 0 infinity, and we subtract off just minus 1/2 times the constant function, then this has Fourier transform equal to the principal value of 1 over s. So to obtain a function whose Fourier transform is the principal value, we just take the characteristic function, we drop it down uniformly by 1/2, and that gives us something I call the sine function. And the sine function is equal to minus 1/2 for y less than 1, and it's equal to 1/2 for y greater than 1, and its Fourier transform is equal to the principal value of 1 over s. And then if you make the usual computation, by shifting and so on, then you'll see that if I shift this, then I get exactly what I'm looking for. So I have a function I'll call sine t. This is equal to minus 1/2 for y less than t. It's equal to 1/2 for y greater than t. And its Fourier transform is equal to t to the minus s over s, the principal value. Okay, and in a sense, that's what we're looking at over here, except for one problem. We have these s's sort of, so we have something that looks like this. What we're looking at here is a convolution. So now, s minus t, I'll write it like this. This is a convolution of my phi, that's a function, well, it's a convolution of phi and t to the minus s over minus s. But the convolution under the Fourier transform corresponds to the product of things. So this is the Fourier transform of the product of phi and this is 1/2 sine. Yeah, it's minus 1/2. That's right. This is 1/2. The sine function just takes plus or minus 1. That one takes it. So I call this this. And so this is minus 1/2 sine t. Okay. So that's what happens for one of these terms. These terms are all more or less the same, right? They're just kind of simple variations on them. I can change variables here. I have phi of s times s and ds, but I can change s to minus s, and then this becomes this with this. And so what I get when I'm all through, when I make all the computations, then what you get. So when I'm all through, so let's see, there's an intermediate step, which I'll skip, and when you're all through, you get the following formula. So I'm all through. I've done all the Fourier analysis and so on. I've taken care of all the little details of the C and combined all the, there's some CTs here and here. They appear. They get here. The becomes phi star because we combine the first two terms. And that, when I change my variables and add those together, everything works out and so on. So that's how you get the phi star, because that's the inverse Fourier transform of phi, a small phi star. And so this is the expression you get. And now, let's see. The other half of it was the following. When I took the CT part, this is equal to the characteristic function of T infinity times phi star, the same constant term. Okay. And now when I add these two together, I get E of phi e to the minus T is equal to 1/2, because this characteristic function, by definition of this, the characteristic function plus the minus 1/2 sine adds out to 1/2, and so you get 1/2 times phi star y to the minus t plus c of minus t y to the t. But phi star, its Fourier transform satisfies the functional equation, and this is equal. So the pairing of this with this and the pairing of this with this are actually the same, and so this becomes phi star of y to the minus t, and that's equal to c star of t. And that's it. That's the answer to the question. Now, this is a lot of work to go to, but it's a lot of fun, actually. I've had a lot of fun doing this, because at every step, the calculation was totally unexpected. It was one of those situations where I just had no idea what was going to come next. And in particular, I had no idea what the principal value meant when I started off on this. when I launch myself in these calculations. But now I'm an expert because I can tell you all about the principal value in higher dimensions, which does not seem to be very well understood. So I'm going to, I have just a few minutes left. I'm not going to give any more proofs. I'm more or less through. But let me tell you what happens for higher rank groups. By the way, I want to say again that it's barely possible that there's some trivial way to do this. I don't think so. I just don't see any easy way. I mean, this argument at least has one virtue, namely, it uses only classical Fourier analysis, although usually on the margins of knowledge for most of us. And it seems a little messy at first. In fact, once you understand the higher rank situation, you can make all the algebra kind of slick, so you don't have to do all these explicit computations. And so when you put it all together in the end, it looks rather nice. First of all, the second of all, it really does look only at the unitary spectrum. I don't even need any existence of the Eisenstein series away from the unitary spectrum. And in fact, the same argument works for p-adic groups and real groups. So what this allows you to do is have a single argument for Poincaré measures for all possible cases of the semi-simple and reductive groups, which doesn't depend on whether you're looking at global or local matters. And I find that kind of interesting, although, I don't know, it has mixed factors for it. So this proof is not elementary in a sense, but every step is elementary. It's just the combination of things that becomes a little tricky. So now let's look at the higher rank case. Now, to do the higher rank case, I'm definitely not going to prove anything. Well, I'm going to prove something, but you won't actually understand what I prove. I have what I call a finite model for Eisenstein series, which I want to explain to you because if you ever read Arthur's papers, this model will save you in some sense, which I'll explain. So Arthur's papers, he's constantly doing two things. He's doing really hard analysis, and he's doing really hard combinatorics. Is that correct? I think they're hard. I think they're just plain hard. And what this finite model will let you do is separate the really hard analysis from the really hard combinatorics. So all the combinatorics can be done on a Euclidean space. And of course, that's more or less what Jim's arguments do, but I think it helps to clarify the situation to actually not only use the arguments but actually to reduce the arguments to the finite case. And so I have what I call the finite model for Eisenstein series. And so let's take W to be a Weyl group. And let's take V to be the root space. And so this contains the roots. And we have a fundamental domain. I'm just going to draw the pictures for SL3. Actually, I better draw them so that they match my pictures. So here's the fundamental domains. So in this case, it's just the permutation group on three letters. And if I take a function on V, just any old function, I define its Eisenstein series to be the function made invariant under the Weyl group, but not its projection. I just take W times F. So that's an Eisenstein series in this case. I have this funny hunch that actually there's something important, really important, going on here. It's sort of like this is the equivalent. If you work with Coxeter groups and Hecke algebras, then you know that you have this parameter Q equals to, well, it's usually a prime power, but it varies continuously. And when you set it equal to 1, you get the finite Weyl group. And something like that is going on here, but how can you... yeah, that's right. But for the Weyl group, it makes sense because you just set Q equal to 1 and you get the finite Weyl group. And there's lots of very deep and interesting theorems about what happens when you vary that Q. So here also is an Eisenstein series for an arithmetic group where the arithmetic group is W. You take away all the stupid analysis. You don't care about gamma. All you care about is that you want the essentialness of the arithmetic group. So you just set it equal to the Weyl group. So this is my Eisenstein series. And of course, you know what parabolic subgroups are. The parabolic subgroups will be the Weyl groups generated by subsets of your delta. So the whole theory goes through, in a sense. There's one wonderful feature, the constant function, C of S, what is it? It's 1. All the constant functions are 1. So the functional equation for Eisenstein series just says E of S is equal to EWS. And that's what That's why it's a convincing model, is because it really does have, you get these C functions, but the C functions cause no trouble whatsoever. They're absolutely harmless. And so you get a full, in some sense, a full-blown model. There are no poles to the Eisenstein series, there are no, but all the combinatorics still exist. And here's the factor. It's just as hard to do Arthur's combinatorics for this case as it is for the usual Eisenstein series. It's neither harder nor easier. It doesn't, it's just exactly the same computation. So, but the funny thing is that by a little work, you can actually reduce all of his combinatorics, as far as I can see, to doing this case, and then you somehow transport it to the Eisenstein series by some interesting tricks, which I won't go into. So as a byproduct of this, it looks like I can, in some sense, do a slightly slicker job of the truncation theory by separating, as I say, into two different steps, one the combinatorics, two the analysis that makes life hard. Ah, so now we want to do truncation, but now, first of all, it's very easy to see what to do for truncation. So for truncation, we have my fundamental domain. I take a point T, and we do truncation by just taking the convex hull, literally the convex hull. And so this is a truncation. So truncation, so lambda T of F is just F restricted to the convex hull of WT. And, well, you get a decomposition of an arbitrary function by, well, you get what's called the Arthur partition, as far as I know, by doing something equally funny. You take your, it's also the Langlands decomposition. They're all the same in this context. It's just marvelous. It's a marvelous world, really. So we take, but you get a different Langlands partition for each one of the corners. So we get a function. That means we have a, I can write each as an F as a sum over parabolics P of lambda T PF. So to say the whole truncation theory goes through. But as I say, the combinatorics is very hard. So there, as usual, with Arthur gives two definitions of truncation, and it's quite hard to show. Well, it's reasonably hard to show they're actually the same. In fact, the same. It's just as hard again to show they're the same here. But you, it's true, and it sort of enhances your understanding of the whole process, I would say. And now the problem in carrying through my proof of the Poincaré formula is you want to find an analog of the sine function, and you want to relate that to principal values. So the problem in higher rank . So first of all, you want to find an analog of the sine function, or minus 1/2 sine t actually is the one you want the analog of, and second of all, you have to relate it to principal values, because that's what arises. When you, the same argument that I gave goes through, basically, you apply Mass-Selberg, and you express that as a sum of principal values. There's no trouble with that. But then you somehow have to get the analog of this, and I'll just show you what it is, because it's a really very pretty thing. I'll just show you what it is for SL3. But there is a definition, and it's valid, and everything works out all right. So for SL3, we do the opposite. So let's look at the roots. See, if I've drawn my roots like this, then that's right. So here's the root diagram. So we take the partition according to the root. So here are my two roots, alpha and beta. Here's minus alpha, here's minus beta. Something like this. I take this, and now the analog of the sine function is 1/6 here, minus 1/3 here, minus 1/3 here, and 1/6 there. And in general, you can expect what happens. So, for example, if I take the group which corresponds to this, then my decomposition looks like this. And in this case, it's 1/8 here, minus 1/2 here, minus 1/2 here, and 1/8 there. So there's all, and this is an analogous construction for actually any arbitrary vowel group, which mirrors a construction of Arthur's again. So it's this partition that you take your characteristic functions with respect to. And then the theory of principal values goes through. We're basically looking at constant functions supported on cones, and there's some sort of easy analog which goes through, and it works out all right. And again, the key fact is that corresponding to this partition, and the key fact, the key property of this, is that this function, so I call this sine WT, when I shift by t. So I put my origin at t, and I shift by t, and I call this sine w of t. And now, the key property of this that makes everything work is that this is equal to 1 over the order of the viral group. Oh, excuse me, equal to 1. I'm very sorry. Just equal to 1. So it's sort of a miracle, but it's actually Arthur's computation. It's exactly the same that he uses to show that the two definitions of truncation are the same and that you just sort of carry that out. So it depends on the Langlands combinatorial lemma in some way. And from this follows almost everything, in particular, corresponding to this decomposition. So, this is not right. It's the convex hull. It's a characteristic function of the convex hull. That's right, sorry. That's what it is, of T. And so, corresponding to this, then you get some sort of inductive decomposition. So corresponding to this partition, you get some sort of partition of the characteristic function of the whole vector space into a sum of sine functions, so to speak. And that's what plays the role in showing that the Poincaré measure works out the way it is. Okay, it's only, I have to say, that what held me up for 14 years was something, and it's really true, it's a very stupid mistake. I'll just mention it, that if I take, very often I'll have some function of S and some other function of S, and they'll each have a principal value. And in the computation that I have, you look at the sum of the principal values. But the sum of the principal values is not equal to the principal value of the sum in general. And for years and years, I'd make exactly the sum calculation over again, but I would always skip from here to here without any hesitation. And it's just over and over again, and I knew that somewhere along the line, I knew that the result was true because I had this finite model, and the finite model, it's more or less everything is really completely obvious the way it has to work out. So I knew that something was wrong, but it just never occurred to me that this was going to be the way things were. But actually, if you start working even just a few simple examples, you can see that this just doesn't work out that way. So it's a warning to something. I don't know what. It took me 14 years. It's really just... Of course, I didn't work very hard at it, I have to say. I mean, I gave up in tears and just stopped immediately and went out drinking or something. But still, it was a very, very stupid mistake to carry on time after time after time. Okay, that's about it.